The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV, politics and the arts, and so much more, and we have a typically diverse show for you this week. Stephen Garrett, our chief film critic, managed to rouse himself on a Saturday morning to go see a sad screening in Manhattan of the movie Death of a Unicorn. That's a movie I saw at South by Southwest here in Austin, to a rapturous standing ovation from an audience that must have been stoned, because the movie is not as good as they thought. Stephen didn't like it at all. I liked it a little bit. We'll talk about it in a while. We're also going to talk to contributor Bobby Hilliard about the recent political turn that the work of comedian Bill Burr has taken. I guess Bill Burr has always had some political content in his act, but he's really going hard in the paint against Elon Musk and hard in the paint for freeing accused murderer Luigi Mangione. And Bobby and I are going to have a lively debate about that coming up. But first, I'm going to talk to contributor Omar Gayaga about the new Seth Rogen sitcom, The Studio, which also premiered at South by Southwest. It's a really sharp and funny satire of movie making and contemporary Hollywood. And Omar and I will talk about it right after this trailer.
So, how do you feel in all this?
You know, I got into this because, you know, I love movies. But now I have this fear that my job is to ruin them.
You're talentless, spineless.
What is wrong with you?
No one likes you.
Get the fuck out of here.
I'm here to save your career. Help me help you win.
You'll make a great studio hit.
When I saw that Seth Rogen's The Studio had premiered at South by Southwest to overwhelming acclaim, I was a little skeptical. First of all, anything that premieres at South by Southwest gets a standing ovation, and if it doesn't, it's got to be a real stinker. The studio just kind of sounded a little bit like insider baseball to me, but then I actually watched it, and I watched the first two episodes, which came out on Apple TV last week, and man, was I surprised. This is the best constructed TV comedy since Veep went off the air, as far as I'm concerned. It's really amazing. And I've got Omar Gayaga, who wrote about The Studio for us and saw it at South by Southwest, is here today to talk to me about it. Hello, Omar.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So as you can tell, I'm enthusiastic about this show. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the premise is.
Yeah, and I agree with you about South by Southwest. You always have to take those screenings with a grain of salt, but it's very good. I've only seen the first two episodes. I think you've only seen the first two. Those were the two that that showed at South by. And it is about a newly appointed studio chief, a newly appointed head of studio at a fictional movie studio called Continental Pictures. Seth Rogen is promoted as a movie executive by Bryan Cranston, who plays the, the owner of the studio, or the, if it were newspapers, it'd be the publisher.
Well, here's a little bit of, talk about insider baseball. Mm-hmm. Cranston's character's name is Griffin Mill, which is the name of Tim Robbins's character in The Player, in Robert Altman's The Player.
Yeah, and apparently Tim Robbins was not offered that part. So, yeah. But no, Cranston does a great job with it. Rogen does a great job with it. And it really, from there, goes to each episode, at least the two that I've seen, are kind of like ongoing panic attacks of this guy trying to balance his love of cinema, his love of movies, with this job where he has to make these really difficult choices and break hearts of directors and stars. He really wants people to like him, but people really don't like him because of the position he's in and the decisions he has to make. And it reminded me of kind of an amalgam of like the Larry Sanders Show,
yes.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, just the way it's structured, the way all these things kind of just harmoniously come together, like a really well-plotted episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it's very cinematic. It's the way it's shot is a lot of long extended, you know, one shots. And that becomes kind of a running joke and theme in the show is these long oneers. In fact, the second episode of the show is called The Oneer, and it is about a director, Sarah Polley, trying to get a perfect shot for the end of her film, and Seth Rogen keeps messing it up.
He bumbles his way through it because he is such a film fan. He wants to see this perfect shot and ends up, you know, making it hard.
Yeah. So overall, it's a big satire of Hollywood, but remarkably loving of, you know, loves Hollywood, but is also satirizing it at the same time, which I think is a really tricky balance that it pulls off. But the show is full of celebrities. Charlize Theron shows up, Greta Lee in the one we were just talking about. It's packed with stars. And because of that, it feels very plausible. It feels like it could really be happening because you don't have the problem with like the show, the franchise on HBO, where there's no real stars in it. There's no real stakes. It doesn't feel like it could be in reality, whereas this one really does.
Yeah, the franchise, but that was Armando Iannucci, right?
And this show has some Veep DNA as well. One of the co-creators, along with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, is one of the writers from Larry Sanders and Veep.
Yeah, Larry Sanders is a good comparison as well. Yeah, the franchise was very clumsy and kind of overplotted. It just wasn't funny. That's really the sort of the main sin. If you're going to do a comedy, you've got to make it funny. And, you know, there are the one shot episode that you mentioned is funny, mostly just because of the sort of the physical comedy that it really leans hard into. Right. It's not too heady. The premise is very simple. You know, Seth Rogen and Ike Barinholtz, who plays his right hand man, his best friend, show up at this film set and just chaos ensues. I liked that episode a lot, but I loved the pilot because it established what I'm assuming is going to be the overarching plot line for the season, which is that Seth Rogen's character, he shows up, he gets this job, and he, you know, this is a guy who loves movies. He desperately wants to make the next Goodfellas. And the first thing that Bryan Cranston pitches him is a movie about based on the intellectual property of Kool-Aid.
Yes.
the Kool-Aid movie. And, you know, they take a very funny meeting with Nicholas Stoller, who is a successful Hollywood type who he made the Muppet movie reboot. And he's very good at dealing with these.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Yeah, he's done some pretty good comedies.
Comedies, but like definitely like someone who you think like, all right, well, that person would probably have a pitch ready for the Kool-Aid movie. But the episode to me takes an incredibly hilarious turn. And I don't want to reveal the main joke is so good that I almost didn't laugh. I just kind of sat there in admiration at how clever the main joke was. Seth Rogen takes a meeting with Martin Scorsese. And played by Martin Scorsese, very, very, very well, I might add. And Scorsese pitches him a movie that Rogen, for a very specific reason, decides to try to turn into the Kool-Aid movie. And it was very clever.
Yeah, I think the joke comes together like 5 seconds before they actually say what the joke is. And if you know, when you piece it together in your head yourself, it's dynamite. It's fantastic. It's a great joke.
It's like, it's really perfect. And I can only, I hope in my heart of hearts that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg came up with that while doing Weekend Bong Hits. And they're like, and it's just this aha moment. And it really, the dude's rug, it really ties the room together. It's just this perfect comic conceit and everything unravels from there. But that moment to me, like, really showed how much promise this show has. I also wanted to, I don't know if you've been following, Rogen's been doing a lot of interviews, obviously, to promote the show. And, you know, he's like talks about like these meetings that he takes in Hollywood and how he's constantly getting yelled at and people are, you know, he talked about how Ridley Scott pitched him on a Monopoly movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard about that.
I mean, he is well positioned to make this show, right? Like this guy's been working successfully in Hollywood for decades.
Yeah. And they talked about this a lot at the South by Southwest screening. You know, they did a little Q&A afterward. They had the stars of the show we haven't mentioned this, but the cast is stacked. I mean, it's Catherine O'Hara and Catherine Hahn and Ike Barinholtz, all of whom are pretty heavy duty comedy, you know, heavy hitters, you know, on top of Bryan Cranston and Seth Rogen. He talked about having these meetings with studio heads. He said he talked to pretty much every major studio head in Hollywood in the creation of this show, and of course all the experiences that he and Evan Goldberg have had over the years making their own movies, and that he has a lot of sympathy for them because they really are trying to do an impossible job, you know, make art and be commercial at the same time. And that, you know, he sensed a lot of sadness in these studio heads, and that there's a line in the show, in the pilot that came directly from a studio head saying, you know, I'm supposed to be making these great movies, but I think my job is really to ruin them.
Yeah.
That's a great line, but that came from reality. That came from him talking to these studio heads. So I think there's a lot of empathy in the show. I think there's a lot of people trying to do good work and somehow ruining that work just by the nature of how the system is set up.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that impressed me the most, I paid to go to this screening. I did not have a South by Southwest badge. I paid to go see this, you know, on my own, and because I had a good feeling about it. I mean, I really think their work has matured, you know, from, you know, go back to Sausage Party or Superbad to, and I know, Goldberg and Rogen didn't write and direct this themselves, but I thought Platonic was a fantastic show that Seth Rogen was in a couple of years ago on Apple TV. So I had a good feeling that they have grown a bit and are maturing and going toward, you know, kind of more striving for a different type of show with this, and that bore out. I mean, I was very pleased with the screening. I was very pleased with the show, and I can't wait to see where it goes, because I think it really represents a big leap forward for that team. I think they're both very smart and talented and very funny. And I think this sort of is the next level for them of growth. You know, I really think this marks a huge step forward for those two guys.
Well, I completely agree with you about that. And I also have a vague hope that, you know, this will lead to some sort of reform or reconsideration in the movie industry of how they do business, or what, you know, how a good movie actually gets made and greenlit. It's an art form that I feel like has been lost in recent years. I mean, we've talked ad nauseum on this program and on Book and Film Globe about the sort of the decline in quality studio films for adults, and there's no guarantee that a show on Apple Plus that is probably mostly being watched by Hollywood insiders is gonna really do any good. But it seems to me that, like, on top of the satire, there's also kind of a sweetness and a hope.
I do, yeah. I and the guy's, you know, he's not a villain. Not even the Bryan Cranston character is a villain. I mean, he just wants to make money. He wants the studio to be successful. But yeah, there's a lot of heart in the show. I feel like a lot of love for cinema, a lot of love for, and, you know, but it is from the perspective of, you know, 40, 50 something dudes, you know, and the movies that they like, you know. So, you know, there's a gratuitous, you know, Goodfellas, you know, homage in the first episode. You know, it's exactly the type of movies you think they would like. But it definitely comes from a place of warmth. Like, despite all the anxiety and the panic inducing, kind of movements of the show. Cause I mean, it does feel like having a panic attack that second episode. Like, there's a lot of anxiety, in this show, but ultimately I think it comes from a very warm place, a place of people that really want to make good cinema, make good films, but are running up against these kind of impossible forces to overcome.
Right. There is a reference in both episodes to Ray Liotta's schlong. So,
good callback from Catherine O'Hara that I think goes into the second episode. I think it's a two episode callback.
It is. So, you know, I don't know if we're going to keep hearing that, but like everything else in the studio, if it's referenced, it's probably true to some extent. So, yeah, anyway, this gets very high marks from Omar and I when we are people of extremely high discernment and good taste. So I think you should check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I we didn't really go into some of the, I think I mentioned some of the stars that are in it, but Catherine O'Hara, I mean, she just chews up every scene she's in. I think she's dynamic in this show. She's fantastic. So if you're a Catherine O'Hara fan.
And she's not playing Moira Rose. She is the greatest comic actress of our time. And just so great to see her do something completely different.
Yeah, and you will be surprised by some of the cameos in the show. Like, there's some really good ones. So, check it out. It's a very, very, very good show.
All right, Omar, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dale. Good talking to you.
This is going to sound odd. What exactly are we saying this is, though?
It's a unicorn.
We need to study it.
I am telling you right now, bad things will happen.
We underestimated it.
Bad
All right, so I saw this movie called Death of a Unicorn at South by Southwest. It was one of the few, well, it was one of the movies I got into, but it was also something that I wanted to see. It was a big world premiere of a fairly reasonably sized budget sci-fi horror comedy starring some big name actors. And I watched it, and because it was South by Southwest, the crowd was just ecstatic about everything. I mean, they're acting like they were seeing the world premiere of Ghostbusters or something like that. Heretofore unseen in cinema, standing ovations for the cast, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought to myself, I'm like, is this movie gonna actually be that popular with audiences? And I think we actually have the answer now that it has been released to absolutely no fanfare and is completely bombing at the box office. I think we see exactly how accurate a bellwether of the popular sentiment South by Southwest is, but I still feel I kind of liked it anyway, and I wanted to talk to Stephen Garrett about it because I was curious what he thinks about this movie, because I don't really talk to you about these kinds of movies, Stephen.
Sure, well, happy to talk about them.
So what do you think? I mean, you saw it today. I mean, was there anyone in the crowd?
I saw it this morning, and there were, I think, three people aside from me there. So there's a lot of room to stretch out.
You know, I mean, look, it's a Saturday morning in New York. There's other things to do.
To be fair,
it's not Friday. Friday night. But you know, here's the thing. Like, this is a pretty big budget movie with some cool special effects, and I feel like it's pretty funny. And you know, it has some good supporting performances. I'm not exactly sure where the lack of interest is in this. What's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have to say this was on my radar, but as with all movies, you know, you kind of swipe left, swipe right. Am I going to see this? Am I not going to see this? You know, and this was one I was going to pass on by unless there was a compelling reason to see it. Of course, your enthusiasm was compelling. So I was curious to see. And it has a great cast, right? Jenna Ortega and Paul Rudd and Richard E. Grant and Taylor Leone. I mean, you know.
Will Poulter
is hilarious.
And Anthony Carrigan, who was NoHo Hank in Barry. I mean, it's a good.
That's right. Yeah.
It's like a decent cast. So there are, you know, there are good comic actors in it. Here's the thing. Like, I feel the setup is that Paul Rudd and his daughter, of course, there's a deceased spouse involved. There always is in these movies, are going to like the countryside of British Columbia to visit his employers, who are like these pharmaceutical executives, these like big, the Sackler family or something. And he and his daughter hit a unicorn in a national park. And that just sets the whole plot in motion. They basically kill a unicorn.
Yeah, they kill a unicorn. But do they kill it? That's part of it too. Like, can you really kill this mythical beast? And
well, there's lots of lore.
I think there's not enough lore. I think that was my problem with it because so these are my two problems. The first is that this family that I think you referred to as sort of a Sackler type family. Here's my takeaway. Sometimes you got to kill a unicorn in order to find the cure to cancer. Like, there are compelling reasons in science and medicine that are morally complicated and challenging that I think can be persuasive and satirical and funny. And I don't think they really made this any of those things to the extent they could have, you know? I didn't feel the family was really that nefarious or villainous. They were just rich jerks who stumble on the cure for cancer and rightly want to profit on the cure to cancer. That's a pretty compelling reason. And then Jenna Ortega is the fair maiden who has sympathy and a connection with the unicorns.
But she's really kind of she's kind of like a left-wing scold.
She's kind of a left-wing scold. And also they say, oh, you mean there's something dangerous about unicorns? And she basically says, yes, I've done the research. And all I can tell you is there's something dangerous about unicorns. She's not very articulate about it. She's not very persuasive about it. And if I were not even the rich family, just an average guy, I would say, yeah, would you please let us kill the unicorn? We found the cure for cancer. This is huge, you know?
Well, okay, but the other unicorns weren't going to let that happen. But that's okay too. That was the best part was when sort of the Jurassic Park-ness of the movie kind of set in, and the unicorns started hunting people in increasingly gory ways, and it was very visceral, let us say.
It is very visceral, yeah. But I feel like the kills aren't quite imaginative enough. The action scenes aren't quite kinetic enough. Like, it just felt a little off, a little dull. The humor wasn't as funny as it should be or as sharp as it should be. The arguments for and against weren't as satiric as they could be. There was just something a bit flat about it that wasn't quite working. And everybody was working really hard to make it work.
I thought it was a lot. I personally found it more fun than you did, although I was somewhat put off by the main performances of Paul Rudd and Jenna Ortega, right? Like, Paul Rudd, I thought, was extremely boring. And his character, I know, was supposed to be boring, but he wasn't fun, nearly as funny as he could have been. And or I just, in general, like, I understand Jenna Ortega's appeal, but I don't really like her persona. Like, I didn't like her in Beetlejuice either. I think she's kind of a bland matinee idol goth chick, you know?
Yeah, she's the sour goth, you know, like you said in your review. She's playing her type, and she's not even been on the scene for that long. So for her to basically be leaning into a type is a little disappointing. I feel like the premise is strong and the actors are talented. I just feel like maybe with a stronger director, a funnier director, or a screenwriter, or a collection of people who know how to riff a bit more, this could have been a real delight.
Like an actual Ghostbusters cast.
Like an actual Ghostbusters cast, exactly, who is riffing. Or like an Adam McKay cast, you know? You think of Paul Rudd and like Anchorman, and they're all having a blast.
I will say this. Okay, yes, I think your criticisms are all extremely apt and accurate, and, you know, really spells out why you can't judge a movie by how it's received at South by Southwest. they're like dogs. They'll like follow you home if you give them like any scrap of meat. but that said, like, I place this movie, and I know this isn't a genre that you really love. Like, when I usually talk to Pablo Gallaga about this on the show, but like, I love this new genre of horror comedy. Like, and like, kind of like, these kind of semi, and yes, this is not the best example of it, but if you were to do a festival of 2020s horror comedy, you'd have to include Death of a Unicorn as like, this is a swing a studio took, right?
Right.
And they tried like this horror comedy thing. And it's just interesting that like the genre is so broad now that there can actually be bad versions of it.
I mean, I appreciate also in your review, you call out Cocaine Bear, which I was mixed on, yeah. But I also found a lot more fun and a little more silly and a little more sharp in the ways that I wish.
Better than this. Better than this. But it's a genre companion.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's the same amount of disemboweling. Yeah, Cocaine Bear was like a little bit more like a wacky Burt Reynolds movie or something. But yeah, but you put this in the category of like Megan and Companion,
right.
Barbarian, Heretic. Like, that's a really interesting collection of movies, I think.
Oh yeah.
So yes, Death of Unicorn, it's not going to be a success. I feel like it's interesting. I got to add one thing before we sign off here, Stephen. So I attended the premiere at South by Southwest, right? And the whole cast was there. The director was there. The director had nothing interesting to say, but the cast was extremely entertaining. And Richard Grant, at one point, somebody asked him a question about what it was like on the set of the movie. And he's like, he looks at her all louche, like, and he's like, "We've been all fucking one another." I'm like, and he was totally kidding. I'm just like, God damn it, he's still going. That's
great. I love Richard E. Grant so much. And Will Poulter was hilarious as the scion, as the bratty little son. Yeah,
he was great. So anyway, let's just let sleeping unicorns lie. Death of a Unicorn is in theaters this weekend, possibly next weekend, and it'll be on streaming so fast. Like, this might not even come out by the time it goes on to streaming. That's just the way shit is working these days. Anyway, Stephen, thank you so much for wasting a couple hours on your Saturday to go see that thing for me.
Never waste. Never waste seeing a movie in a theater.
Comedian and actor Bill Burr is currently starring on Broadway in a revival of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross, one of the greatest American plays, and it's got an incredible cast, includes Burr and Kieran Culkin and a bunch of other excellent actors. And he's been hitting the talk show circuit to promote his appearance on the play. He's been saying some pretty provocative stuff, provocative enough. And it's a conversation that sort of he started having in the media like almost as soon as Donald Trump was re-elected. So I thought it would be a good idea to feature story about Bill Burr and what he's up to, because he's a significant cultural figure, significant enough for us, certainly. And I've got Robert Dean, or Bobby Hilliard, whoever he wants to be called. He wrote the piece, and he's here today to talk to me about what Bill Burr is up to. Hello.
Howdy.
All right. So what is Burr doing, basically?
Bill Burr is essentially using his platform as a diamond tier household name comedian to shit all over the elite class of American politics, which I absolutely love.
Sure. I mean, who doesn't love it when a comedian shits all over the elite class of American politics? That's what comedians should be doing instead of, you know, talking about their dicks. I go see a lot of stand up and it's like, I'm like, come on, people, read Twitter, pick up a newspaper, do something, think about something other than airplane food or your sex life. So, you know, Bill Burr is well past that. My question is for you, Bobby. Well, here's my question. Burr has been spending a lot of time taking shots at Elon Musk, well-deserved shots. I mean, Elon Musk is, whatever you think about his cars, he's a ridiculous public figure, and he's well worth making fun of and satirizing. And he's also been sort of pimping or simping or whatever for Luigi Mangione. He's been a prominent voice saying, free Luigi, that the CEO that Luigi Mangione allegedly murdered got what was coming to him. He's been going at the billionaires, the billionaire class. What I'm wondering is, where was he before this? It's not like these problems are anything new. Why suddenly has he popped out of the egg and started ranting about these things in particular?
I think given the trajectory of Burr's career, I've been a Bill Burr fan since he had hair. Uh-huh. And I've been with him since like the club days.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you have to look at the trajectory of him as a comic. He's always had that everyman sensibility about his work that I think he stayed grounded, that a lot of guys lose touch. Like Bill Burr is famous, but he never became a leading man. He didn't go Kevin Hart, complete sellout. He's taken projects in Hollywood, but if you look at him, they've always been like, he's doing Glengarry Glen Ross. He was a bad guy in Star Wars. He's done like working class movies. So he stayed true to who he is with the projects he's involved in and even in the characters he plays. So if you see the trajectory of how his comedy works, he's kind of ramped up. Each special arrives at more and more clarity. And it's like Carlin did the same thing. Because if you look at how Carlin worked, the ones that are the most quoted are his last decade or so, 15 years of specials. That's when he became the George Carlin you see on the internet clips and the, you know, it's a big club and you ain't in it. Like my lock screen is George Carlin. He's my favorite comedian of all time. Bill Burr is probably my second. And it takes a while to get to the place where you can have the right kind of political ideology, political informedness, but also be able to take it and spin it in a way that is relatable, funny, but also informative. And that takes a certain kind of mastery of not only language, but thought. And I think that he's arrived there. And finally, he is the answer to Rogan and Tony Hinchcliffe and all them going ostensibly to the right and vocally so. He's the anti to that.
I would agree with you there. And here's the thing, right? Like, there's no question, right, that the political right or the, you know, right-wing populism as represented by Donald Trump is the man now. I mean, they are the man. They run everything. So any comedian who, at this point, who is kind of backing what they're putting out is shilling for the man. And, you know, the best comedy to me is oppositional. My thing about Burr is, look, and I think he's super good. You know, I mean, even when I disagree with what he's saying, like he always makes me laugh. He's just funny as hell. Watching him deliver a set is like just watching a great pitcher just whizzing fastballs all game and dropping in a good curve. Here's the thing, though. I don't really feel like his politics are that consistent. Like, for instance, he almost lost his house in the LA fires, like a lot of rich LA people. And he talked about how he has a helicopter. He owns a helicopter. And if he was going to have to make a Sophie's choice, whether he picks his wife or his child to escape in the helicopter, because it was only a two-seater. And I'm like, that's not relatable. You know, a guy who has a helicopter in his backyard. You know, I mean, the fact that he admitted it is funny. And also, like, he wasn't, like, super critical of, like, let's say, like, someone like Adam Carolla, who is super critical of the L.A. establishment and how badly they have managed the fires and managed the recovery from the fires, you know, and the insurance companies there. Bill Burr has held his fire on that. So I'm just like, if you're going to criticize the man, be consistent.
I don't think that it's necessarily... I'm not like kowtowing to, I just think that he probably didn't have like a thought through line with that, if anything. I mean, that's realistically like the guy almost lost all of his shit.
Sure.
I think through the trauma of the moment, I think probably down the line, he will have something to say about it. But I think the trauma of the moment of like, hey, I might lose my shit. I have to pick between my wife and my kid.
It's somewhat relatable, I guess. But I guess what I'm saying is, in some ways, like, he's preaching working class revolution, right? Or at least working class, like, revolutionary ideas. I don't think he's actually preaching a revolution. But, you know, he is a very, very wealthy man. And he wouldn't be first up against the wall, but he'd be in the early phases. You know, he's a rich, rich dude.
Oh, I mean, he's a rich dude. And it's more or less like how I'm an open... You know, when I'm not writing things for Book and Film Globe, I am a political writer. I am an open socialist. I have made no bones of having a career in political writing for 2 decades now. I just see things through that lens, and I'm appreciative of the fact that, like, somebody with his strata is bringing up the things that a lot of us down here in the cheap seats, as I wrote in my piece, aren't given the platform to do. I've had a modicum of success just as you have. But we are no way in that kind of world of owning a helicopter. I'm lucky to pay rent. And so I appreciate when somebody goes against the popular conversation of the fucking thing that's happening around us that some people are too proud to admit is a fucking nightmare.
All right. But here's the thing. The thing that's happening around us that you're talking about, if it was happening around us, my politics don't lean even remotely as far to the left as yours do. If it was happening, it was happening a year ago at this time as well, you know, when the Democrats were running everything. I mean, if you're going to credit, you know, it's not like suddenly, yeah, a lot of things changed politically when Trump was reelected, but Democrats have, there's a lot of billionaire money behind the Democratic Borg as well. And I,
oh, sure.
And I know you understand that. But I feel like my politics changed forever, right? During the pandemic, right? I saw bourgeois liberals living the high life while working people and, you know, middle-class people who just wanted to send their kids to school, people who just wanted to go on with their lives were sort of made to suffer under these rules that were imposed. Bill Burr was kind of just shrugging his shoulders, like, ah, I'll go on tour next year, you know? It didn't affect him. So I don't know, I'd like to see some consistency. I know that's not necessarily what you're going to get out of him. To me, it feels a little bit like champagne socialism coming out of his mouth.
I wouldn't necessarily think it's champagne socialism. I think that he's finally coming to a place, which I think a lot of people in their careers do. Like, and I say this without hubris or a pointed reference, and this is just in injecting myself into this as well. I've made the choice of doing what I do at the fraction of the thing of, I realize that the death camps, I have no faith in the current administration whatsoever. I think they're a pack of bumbling fucking idiots. And if they were to line up journalists, I realize I'd be one of the ones shot in the head. I can live with that.
But that's not going to happen. You're not going to have to. You know, Bill, I guess what I'm saying is I don't feel like, just like pro-Trump or pro-MAGA comedians are not consistent in their unwillingness to sort of criticize things when things are not going well for their side, I feel like liberal comedians, and I would put Burr in that camp, most of the time do not apply the same pressure consistently. So when he's talking about billionaires, he's not talking about billionaires who are donating to Democratic causes. He's talking about Elon Musk and a handful of others who are currently like wielding the levers of power. So I don't know. It's a kind of a, it just feels, it's like a fake populism, which isn't to say he's not a hilarious guy.
No, but I would push back against that because given the opportunity of thought, Elon Musk is the center of controversy right now for all the right reasons. that dude sucks. Is what, like, I'm sure if we got onto the conversation, I'm sure if I Googled it, he's probably got a quote shitting on Bill Gates and things like that. The difference is Bill Gates isn't going on TV with a black hat and a chainsaw, and fucking Trump isn't putting Microsoft computers on the front lawn. He's a, if there's a reason to make the joke, it's there. Like I said, I guarantee you can probably do some swift Googling and find other things, but like the moment is so egregious that it calls for like to be called out. And again, what he's saying isn't in line with typical liberal politics. Liberals are capitalists that still rely on daddy to keep the bills paid versus what he's saying.
I know he's saying free Luigi, which I like fully do not agree with.
And I fully agree with.
All right. Well, that's fine. You know, you can support a murderer. I mean, I do.
I have no love in my heart for billionaires.
Well, all right. Well, you know, I have neither love nor hate in my heart for billionaires. What I don't like is, you know, capital murder being performed in broad daylight. But the thing is, like, that this is a debate that you and I have had before and will continue to have. The fact, you know, it is interesting that Bill Burr is out there saying this stuff. I found myself, like, when I first started hearing that, writing something angry about it. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be like a guy writing an angry anti-Bill Burr screed for the National Review or whatever. I still think he's funny. I just think that he was soft on the pandemic, and now he's hard when it's convenient to do. He was soft.
Did you hear what he said on Rogan about the pandemic?
I don't recall that, no.
No, he was he did a Rogan thing where he was fucking completely combative against Rogan's opinions because Rogan started saying stuff. And he's like, no, he's like, you ain't, he's like, you're not a doctor. You don't know what's good. He goes, just listen to some people, get yourself in order. Like it's a whole thing where like they go back and forth and he's like, you're not a doctor, Joe. You're a comedian who's a millionaire. And he was taking him to task on that.
Bill Burr is also not a doctor. And the side that he took has been like systematically disproven over the course of the last 4 years. So I'm saying like, he's not always right.
Sure.
The key is he's usually pretty funny, and I would sell my left nipple to go see him and Kieran Culkin and Glengarry Glen Ross, which is just one of the great plays of all time. I mean, the casting is freaking incredible for that. He also has a new special out on Hulu,
which is very good.
And I wouldn't say it's apolitical. And you know, the thing is, like, he was the first SNL host after the election, and he came out and was like yarping against liberal feminists and like saying like not flattering things about Trump, but like funny things about Trump working at McDonald's. So, you know, he's not the most predictable person.
No. And I think that he's a voice that we desperately need in the mainstream, because realistically, if you look at the playing field right now of popular culture, you have the typical Hollywood liberalism, which is people crying about every fucking thing that no one who has to work for a paycheck experiences or cares about. And then on the other side, you have this breed of America who are firmly entrenched in their cultist mindset. And you have the comedians that go along with that. Some of the comics that I know personally just like the chaos of it. And they like the insanity of all this, where their worldview is just so different than other people's. And I appreciate somebody taking their time with that platform being like, this is fucking insane. I hate to sound like the boomer in the room, but when I was a kid or up until about 10 years ago on talk shows, radio shows, parts of middle America were getting thinkers and we were getting writers and other people who and journalists on talk shows. And there was an exchange of ideas. Now we have YouTubers who fart for a living. We don't have anything like Dick Cavett now.
Well, Dick Cavett was never exactly a bard of the working class there, Bobby, but sure.
No, but I mean, he had Hunter Thompson and he had Ginsburg and he had those like thinkers of the time.
There should be more conversations in mainstream media about overthrowing capitalism. I agree.
Not necessarily that, but we should be having conversations with like outside of CNN and Fox News based things, like people that are kind of like, hey, let's explore why you're offended and why I feel this way. We don't even allow to have conversations anymore.
I don't know. We're having a conversation right now. I would say like, you know, painting Bill Burr as the authentic bard of the forgotten American is perhaps maybe a little, uh, little strong, but you know,
hey, that's my fucking job, guy.
He got us going for 20 minutes on a Thursday afternoon. Bobby Hilliard's, or he goes and writes for us under the name Robert Dean, his piece about Bill Burr and the sort of this political turn he's taken is on Book and Film Globe right now. Bobby, I'll talk, if I survive the revolution, I'll talk to you when it's over.
Yeah, I'll be there on Blue Sky and TikTok making videos about how you should buy my books, but also my daily political thoughts, which I do every day.
All right, we'll tune in. Thanks. All right, thank you so much. Bobby Hilliard, he writes for us under the name Robert Dean. He wrote a piece praising the work of Bill Burr. He is an avowed socialist. I am an avowed anti-socialist, and yet we still are able to be friends and colleagues and talk about things. What do you know? I also talked to Stephen Garrett about Death of a Unicorn, a movie that will very, very soon be on streaming platforms. It died a horrible death at the box office. Film finished way behind many films. And I also talked to Omar Gayaga, one of our TV critics, about The Studio, which is a terrific new Seth Rogen satire about movie making and Hollywood, and it's on Apple Plus, and you should definitely check it out. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, which owns two terrific independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse in Long Branch on the Jersey Shore. If you are in New Jersey, stop by one of our stores or use us as an affiliate link on bookshop.org. Thank you so much for supporting us and for supporting the arts and culture in America. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Original production.